Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome and hello. This is Joseph G. with Rum Radio and rumradio.org, the most comprehensive 12-step sponsorship in the known and the unknown universe, which is shrinking as we speak. I'd like to acknowledge WNAH, Tony the Horse, who affords us the opportunity to broadcast live to their listening audience in Nashville, parts of Kentucky, and Alabama as a public service presentation. We'd also like to acknowledge RecoveryToday.net magazine. It's one of the finer recovery journals that affords us some print space from time to time. Normally, I would introduce Harold B., my co-host. He's a family intervention specialist. Harold opted not to be with us tonight. We have a special guest tonight, special show, Jennifer M., who wrote the book Living Promises. She's a coach and a writer and a deep thinker. And this will be real interesting, so let me get started as we normally do. I like to start off the program with on a spiritual note. I believe the 12-step program is a gift from God. I tell my church that their own 12-step program. I've been trying to get AA into their rooms under their roof and under their auspices as AA.
Sure, I just went on it.
I asked them if the 12 steps are not a gift from God, why have you adopted them? And if they are a gift from God, why do you feel compelled to change them? Of course, I never get an answer, and everybody goes their own way with their own little shtick. And the agreement is, if it works for you, it works. So one of the first assignments I give them, first I ask them, I wait until they get their beginner's chip. I get around the circle. We usually have a closing prayer. Sometimes usually we hold hands. It's usually the Lord's prayers in this neck of the woods, someplace that's other prayers that are said, sometimes not. But this is most of the time it's some kind of benediction that's said at the end of the meeting. And if someone's gotten their beginner's chip, which I believe is the beginning of their acknowledgement that their life had become manageable and that they do have the disease of alcoholism. They've made the acknowledgement of the problem. I get around the circle and I grab his hand. Boys with boys, girls with girls, when possible. He is to work the steps, but this isn't a suggestion when possible. And I have a hold of his hand. At the end of the prayer, I'll turn around to him and I'll ask him, have you had enough? Yes or no? Sometimes I'll get the question. If they're really ready, they don't ask what that means. Sometimes I'll ask, what do you mean, have I had enough? Have you had enough alcohol? Have you had enough pain? Have you had enough misery? Have you had enough?
Yes, because it gives you an option.
Are you willing to go to any length to achieve sobriety? Yes or no? Yes. I tell them you can get well from this disease of mind, body, and spirit, but there's certain things you have to do. And I carry this around with me when I'm looking for a sponsee, Clancy 7 Questions. It's the website underneath this. I find the sponsee tab, and I give them the 7 questions. The first thing I need you to do is answer these 7 questions, and I need them back tomorrow. Here's my number. I expect your call.
Yeah, it should have been on automatically.
Nice and clean. I don't worry if they call. Great. If they don't call, two things. Either they're not ready or they're not ready for me. In any event, I'll just go to the next fella. There's somebody that I can help, but I have to concentrate on someone who's interested.
Something happened to knock it
off. If I get that back, one of the first assignments I give them, for the next 30 days, I want you to get a newcomer's packet. First, you get a newcomer's packet or the names of 20, 25 men in your home group. You get a home group because we're connected now. That's your family. I like to think of it, we're less than kin and more than kind. Survivors from a common shipwreck. And you get these fellas' names, they become your lifeline. So you have 20, 25 names, hopefully, either on a sheet of paper or newcomer's packet, which I really encourage most groups to get when possible.
And with those names, you call them every day. You call one of the names every day for the next 30 days, and you ask them to permission to recite the third step prayer. Third step prayer is found on page 63 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Why I have them do that, and I always explain anything I do because we're dealing with adults. Maybe a lot of inner children, but these are adults, and I always like to give people rationale. The first reason is that it's to get used to picking up the 500-pound telephone and asking for help.
I guess it's one of those mysteries.
I can help somebody, but I don't like anybody to help me. So this is asking permission to help somebody. Or to be of service.
When I logged on,
I asked them to do that. Is because now like they're connecting up with their home group.
Show.
People get to know their name. You get to know your name.
Started automatically when I logged
third
in.
The reason is that the third step prayer, I also call the surrender prayer. It gives us an idea of what we're going to be trying to accomplish by working all 12 steps of the program. Of Alcoholics Anonymous or the addiction flavor of your choice.
All right,
all the steps are the same except for step one, which actually mentions the substance or the particular addiction. The rest of the 11 steps are the same. We call that a design for living or the solution. And fourthly, and maybe it might even be the most important, the fellow that you were calling might have been thinking about picking up his first drink, his first hit of crack, his first whatever. And when you recite that prayer to him, the chances are he will not. No guarantees in this thing, but I have the sponsee already in action and in service. So I find this to be really productive. Here's the prayer.
Yeah, you figure
God,
once you started,
I offer myself to thee, to build with me, and do with me as I will.
And there was
relieve
no reason
the bondage
to
of self.
Continue. That, see, I'll that fall in.
Take away my difficulties.
And then I have to,
victory
when
over
when
them.
I
they bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Can I get an amen on that? Amen. I'd like to introduce our interview, Jennifer M. You there, Jennifer?
I'm here, Joseph. How are you?
I'm really good. Thank you. And thank you so much for joining. Let me take a second and give out the number in case you'd like to talk to Jennifer. If you had any questions or comments, we'd be more than interested in fielding your conversation. The guest call in is 949-534-0621. Again, 949-534-0621.
Okay, so you don't even.
Jennifer has written a book, Living Promises, Coming to Life on the Road of Recovery. And Jennifer was kind enough to send me a copy.
Yeah,
it's great. Actually, I liked it so much, I probably would have even spent my own money.
That's good to know.
And if you know me, that's saying a lot.
Damn.
I throw nickels around like manhole covers.
And then the clock will just continue to roll. The clock has nothing to do with it.
Now, the AA promises.
On or not? That's
the AA promises.
Don't go on. You
find the AA promises in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous on and around the ninth step.
No, I didn't.
So tell us about why you wrote the book.
Well, it was kind of an interesting progression, I would say. I hit my 25th anniversary in recovery in 2010. And 25 was significant for me. It's a big number to begin with. And based on when I got sober in my life, it represented a milestone that was also representative of being more than half my life now that I'd been.
Well, check
sober.
It anyway because sometimes
because I got sober when I was just shy of my 24th birthday. So 25 was like now I'm more sober than I ever was not. So at 25, I was with some friends of mine, some girlfriends of mine. We were all talking about what was on our horizon for business or projects or this or that. And I said, you know, the most significant thing that's happening for me at the moment, business kind of business as usual. But it's recovery anniversary of mine, and it's a really big thing for me. And I had published a book in 2006, a business book.
No,
and
it just
so I'd gone
beginning.
Through that process before, and I said, you know, I've been wanting to write another book. I didn't know what it was going to be. I think I need to write a book about my experience. I didn't know when I made that decision, however, that it was
going to
turn out to be a day-at-a-time inspirational or meditation book. That kind of revealed itself over time.
Oh, I did log in. I logged in.
In your acknowledgement, you talk about the magical steps. You took these magical steps, and it expressed the way of your gratitude was writing this book. I like the term magical. I'd say
they told me that was
that was saved by grace. One of the little sticks I came up with: saved by grace after all that we can do. Not after all that we can talk, not after all that we can think, not even after all that we can pray. The magical words in AA is action and more action, for faith without works is dead. So you felt the magic and you had the gratitude.
Well, and I also had the experience from having worked these steps over and over and over in my own life, working them with sponsees, you know, the literature, et cetera, I knew that if my intentions were right, that if I were doing this for the right reason, which was to share my experience, strength, and hope with the hope that it would help another person who suffers from this disease, that the rest of it would reveal itself.
Yeah,
and that was absolutely true. The first thing I did when I decided I was going to write a book was I reached out to another author in this field that your listeners are probably very familiar with, Karen Casey. Karen's written more than 25 books in the recovery genre, if you will, and her, I think her best-selling book, Each Day a New Beginning, was one of the first meditation books I got when I first got sober. I mean, I think I got it, my first edition of that, when I was 3 months sober. And so here I am 25 years later, and I said, well, I'm going to reach out. I'm going to see if I can find this Karen Casey person and ask for her advice.
Right.
And she was a lot easier to find than I thought she would be.
Yeah.
She was just one of those doors that kind of opened. Yeah. I found her. I found an email for her. I wrote to her. I was being very pure in my intention and clear about why I was writing to her. I'm thinking about writing about my own experience. I would appreciate any advice or feedback you might have. And Karen wrote back to me very shortly after that and said, write every day and let the spirit move you and it will reveal itself. And it just absolutely did that. You know, I put up a Facebook page and started to post every day and found my voice in the writing, Joseph, and started to get feedback from the people who were joining that page and what they found inspirational about it, and they shared their own stories, as you know we love to do. And before I knew it, the book was written, and the community had grown on that Facebook page to some beautiful number of people that were supporting each other every day, and so it was magical. I just kept every day getting up at 5 in the morning, praying and meditating and writing what came up, and a year later it was a book.
Interesting. Did you ever see that movie, The Jerk, with Steve Martin?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And the last scene is when he becomes an alcoholic and he's in the alley, and his family finds him, and he asks, "How long have you been looking for me?" And they go, "This is the first place we look."
Well, that's how you learn.
It reminded me when you said that you thought it might be a hard time finding her, and it was like you opened the door and there she was, kind of.
There she was. Yeah, Googled her and found an email. There she was. And she has been an extraordinary support in the process. She has been, I can't say enough for Karen and her work, and just, I got a chance to meet her earlier this year at a women's writing workshop that I attended. She actually lives part of the year in my hometown in Naples, Florida. And when I launched my book at the beginning of this year, the book tour, I made sure that I got down to Florida at the same time she was doing this writing workshop and got a chance to meet her. And she is delightful. I mean, she is as genuine as I had hoped. Lovely woman.
And then you mentioned Debbie Phillips, who did, I think, the design of the book.
Actually, Melanie Warner is the person who did the design. Debbie is my coach. Debbie is the one that I, she's my business and personal coach. She has been coaching me on my visions for my life since 2006, I believe, 2005 even maybe, when I wrote my first book. And Debbie is extraordinary. She is what I call pure love. She is so enchanted by and moved by the accomplishments of others and what she can do to support that. It is her whole essence. And
yeah,
I'm very,
yeah.
very
I
fortunate that
my
I have counsel from her.
Didn't have Wi-Fi.
And
she
then Anne Rattel.
I went up there. She didn't have it.
My darling, darling friend, Anne. Anne is a success strategist, psychologist. She is brilliant. She is, it's funny. I have to say that one of the coolest things about Anne's and my relationship is that we met at a women's conference seven years ago. We hit it off instantly. She was one of those people that I just fell in love with immediately. Very genuine, very authentic. We just hit it off like a house on fire. And we, in that period of time, have only seen each other face-to-face, I think, four or five times. A couple times she's been to Denver. Couple times I've been to San Diego now. Of course, we've been on the phone with each other countless times. We had a mastermind group together with our businesses and our projects where we would talk on the phone at least once a week and support each other. But it's a really interesting thing when you meet somebody like that, that you just know, and no matter how much time goes by in between conversations, you're going to pick up right where you left off, and she is a phenomenal champion for people's success. And Melanie, who you mentioned a moment ago, who did the book design, is another genius friend of mine. She's fantastic. Melanie has this extraordinary ability to see what's on my mind when I explain to her a vision that I have. She was the designer for my first book. And my husband met her in a coffee shop. My husband used to meet the greatest women. He'd come home with a business card and say, I met this great woman. You have to meet her.
30,
and Melanie was one of those people. And I said, as long as you bring home the card and not the girl, I'm all good. So Melanie was one of those people when she lived in Denver. And we, another person I just met and fell in love with, and her brilliant, brilliant creative mind.
No, it started from the beginning.
So when I came around with this next book and asked her to do the work on that, she was on board, I think, faster than instantly.
My grandfather used to say, show me your friends and I'll tell you who you are.
But I have it set up for 90 minutes.
That's a great saying.
It's an old Italian saying. It sounds even better in Italian, but that you get the gist.
I do.
Yeah. A good friend can tell you what is the matter with you in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Although he may not seem such a good friend after telling you.
Exactly.
I've done that. I have a tendency to be a little too blunt, frank and earnest kind of deal.
That's right.
And it's gotten me in trouble more than one time. I was at a church function. I hang out sometimes with the evangelicals. That's not my flavor, but I'm a perpetual student. I go wherever I think I might learn something. I had a roommate that was in the program. He was of the flavor of evangelical, too, and had a hard time with him. And there was a lot of negative stuff that comes on. And someone asked me the other night, we've heard negative things about John. Can you... what's your experience? So I turned around and I said, it's not what goes into a man's mouth that defiles him, it's what comes out.
When I got on, it started right from the beginning.
And they took that as something, and they went on, just like I said, something negative, and had this whole dialogue without me saying another word about it. It was like they already had made up their mind what I was going to say. And when I said that, was so not to say anything derogatory. People just picked it up anyway. It was the strangest feeling. It was weird. I mean, it was just kind of strange. Like, I was trying not to say anything. Gossip, you know, I heard the only thing that travels faster than bad news
no matter what,
is good gossip.
It's fun or not, with its voice on. on it.
I heard a preacher say one time, gossip was the devil's radio.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
And your husband, pardon me?
Go ahead.
Your husband, now your husband seems like he's very supportive. How long have you been married, and did you meet him in the program? Or?
Husband is fantastic, yes. I don't think he'll mind me. Ever since I got so public about my recovery, although neither of us has really kept ours a secret, you know, of course, when people get into the discussion about my recovery in the book, they find out that he also has been in recovery for a good while. I will celebrate 27 years in recovery on Tuesday, and Les has 22 years now. I met him 2 weeks after I moved to Denver in a meeting, and made sure that he had at least a year when I met him.
I understand.
And, we were laughing about that at a recovery party last night. We were celebrating somebody else's birthday last night and laughing about that, making sure that, well, and I was serious about it. You know, I mean, I was only 5 years sober at the time, but I was serious about, you know, how long you've been doing this deal. And he is phenomenal. He has been my biggest supporter ever that I could ever have dreamed of. And we've been married 20 years. We got married a year after we met. And we've been through a ton together. Built huge businesses, lost huge businesses, houses, cars, bank accounts, large to small. And we've managed to maintain our sense of humor. We've said, you know, repeatedly, we're not drunk or divorced. We're in good shape. So we push forward, and he knows when it's book writing time. So I'm working on my next book, and he says, is it time for me to start throwing food under the door of your office again? And I said, yeah, kind of, but I'll come out every once in a while. He's amazing.
That reminds me of that that movie, Roger Rabbit. You remember the that movie, and the character goes, what do you see in Roger? And Jessica Rabbit goes, he makes me laugh. Does that laugh?
Well,
does Les make you laugh? Does he make you laugh?
Yes, he makes me laugh, and he's an amazing cook, and he is, I would say, the kindest soul I've ever met. He's just a very kind, wonderful gentleman.
Now, I like to think of it this way. The bigger the sinner, the greater the saint. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, that we can use that experience to help others. So my experience is that the further down the scale you've gone, the greater asset you're going to be in the program of recovery. Tell me about how far down the scale you've gone.
Well, you know, a lot of times, and it's funny, and you I'm sure experienced this as well in conversations with people in recovery. It's interesting because, you know, when I tell people that I got sober at 23, and I say 23, 24, because I was literally 2 months shy, a month and a half shy of my 24th birthday, they either say, wow, it must have been really horrible to get sober that young, or it must not have been so bad, and did you really need to? And I did. I truly did need to. I started drinking when I was 13. By the time I was 15, I had added some drugs to the mix. Mostly, you know, pretty light drugs, although the alcohol was taking me out of school, and I had studied since I was a kid to be a professional dancer. It was starting to interfere with that career. By the time I was 17, I was adding heavier drugs to the mix with the alcohol. By the time I was 18, I was 24/7. And so by the time I was 24, I was in horrific shape. And there was some sort of chemical that was driving every time frame of the day. You know, you wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and drink whatever's on the nightstand so that you can just stop shaking enough to close your eyes for another few hours and get up and pour something out of a bottle and that you puke up a few times until you can get that to stay down. And I was off and running for the day. You know, and a little bit of weed and a little bit of coke and some pills and, you know, a little mixture of whatever to get through the day until the alcohol could take over again at night. And what comes with that, you know, because it was, I was an absolute maintenance alcoholic and drug addict. The level of maintenance was what was so high, you know, as far as the amount of alcohol and the amount of drugs that it took to maintain. And, you know, what comes with that is every dashed dream, every broken relationship, every absence of moral standards that one could imagine. I mean, I gave up every moral and value that I had ever been raised with, and I was raised with a whole bunch of them, for the sake of what it would take to get high, to get drunk. So, you know, that involves everything. That's the lying, the stealing, the cheating, the manipulating, the driving whatever had to be driven in order to get it done. And by the time I was done, I wasn't even sure what I was done with, but I was just over. There was nothing left in me that I could get a hold of that felt like it was worth sticking around for.
Your jumping off point, what did that look like?
Also a pretty interesting story, I think. You know, my mother had gotten sober the year before I did, and she and I had lived together for a few short years after. When she and my dad divorced was when her alcoholism really accelerated. And so in a 3 to 4 year period, she was, you know, like at her bottom fast. And she was in the mental health field. So the people she worked for in the treatment center said, you know, gee, you need to go to treatment. Like, it really wasn't an option. They sent her to treatment. Well, I was still drinking and drugging at the time. And when she finally told me where she was headed for this 30-day disappearance, of course, you know, I was still active in my addiction. It was all about me. I was like, well, wait a minute, how am I going to get in the house? And, you know, why are you going away? And who's going to cook for me? And she was like, Jennifer, I'm going to treatment. Okay. So I had an inkling about alcoholism at that point. It wasn't the first time I'd ever heard of it, for sure, but I was like, wow, this is the closest to home. It didn't get through, though. I mean, I saw her in treatment Thanksgiving. She was there during Thanksgiving, and I remember driving up to see her. I was so sick and hungover from the night before that I was smoking a lot of pot just to keep from throwing up in the car, literally. And I'm driving up to see her at the treatment center, about a 45-minute drive, and thinking, God, I can't believe my life is so screwed up that I have to go see my mother in treatment on Thanksgiving, and I'm not having a regular Thanksgiving dinner, which is so perfectly indicative of our crazy, mixed-up little egos. So I saw
her there.
What's that?
I have a granddaughter, 8 years old, and we'll go back and forth sometimes, and I'll go, you know, it's really all about me, Claire. And she'll go, no, it's about me. And I said, no, it's about me. And we'll go back and forth until she starts laughing. And it helps me being around an 8-year old because that makes
sure.
me a better sponsor.
Exactly.
Because
well, so
it's all about me.
And I got up there to the treatment center, and I walk in, and my mother walks out. She'd been there for about 3 weeks, and she walks out to greet me, and she looks as beautiful, as rested, as grounded as I ever remembered seeing her in my life. And I was so confused because I was like, what is wrong with this picture? Like, she can't leave. She looks great. I feel like, you know what? And I get to walk out of here after we're done. I was just that confusion, but nothing stuck, and I stuck around, and I had dinner with her, and I laughed, and I went on my merry way. Well, I went back to college, actually, the next year. My parents both said, you know, things were getting a little out of control with me and my lifestyle. How would I like to go back to school? And so I said, sure, you know, you're buying, I'm flying. And as though it was really my choice, right? Like, I knew at that point I was kind of out of choices. And so as soon as I got up to South Carolina from Florida to this college, I started negotiating with myself. I'll only drink beer during the week, and then I'll save the hard stuff for the weekend, and I won't do, you know, drugs at all unless it's a party. I mean, just the crazy negotiating stuff we do, which lasted about 2 weeks. And by that time, I had found people that I could hang out with that drank and partied like I did, and it accelerated, accelerated, accelerated. So the jumping off point for me to your question was one particular night. I was at a friend's house at her apartment. I had known her from years ago. We reconnected when I moved to South Carolina. I was in the business of really just using whatever I could of hers, you know, stealing her money, stealing her drugs, taking advantage of the baby, whatever. Well, this particular night was no different than any other I thought, except that she'd had it, and she threw me out, and she made her sister take me back to my dorm and said, get out and don't come back until you can be a human being. And I was devastated. Again, it was, you know, how dare she? I mean, she drank like I did, and she was the one with the problem, whatever. So I woke up the next morning, and I had that soul sickness. Of course, physically, I was just ridiculously sick from all of the things that I had taken the night before, but the soul sickness was what really had caught up with me that morning, and I was shaking, I was crying, and so I called my mother. And I called my mother, and she got on the phone, of course, said, you know, what's wrong, honey? And I said, well, my friends drink too much, and I don't want to drink anymore. And she chuckled a little bit and said, well, tell me about it, honey. And I poured out my heart about my, you know, horrible friends and how mean they were to me. And she said, well, you know what? Maybe Al-Anon would be someplace that would be helpful for you. And I said, Al-Anon, that's perfect. I can go to Al-Anon, figure out every drunk in my life, and my life will get better. I mean, and my mother's a sneaky, sneaky, smart, smart woman. So I know I was going to get off the phone with her. I called probably an AA central office, you know, kind of number, told them where I was on campus. They gave me a number to a club nearby, which, by the way, was literally, and still is, literally a little white house at the end of a street by a railroad track. So I call this thing, and I get this guy on the phone, and I said, my name is Jennifer, and I want to come to an Al-Anon meeting because my friends drink too much, and I don't want to drink anymore. And he laughed and said, okay, well, we can see you, you know, this, this, or this, and it turned out that next Friday was going to be the soonest I could go, and I spent the entire week, well, the next couple of days anyway, telling everyone who would listen to me about how I was going to go to an Al-Anon meeting and solve all of my problems. Because I was going to figure out my family and my friends. And they all kind of looked at me like I was a little nuts anyway. But in the meantime, my sneaky mother put a pamphlet in the mail to me, the Young People in AA pamphlet that has those 20-some-odd questions of say yes to four or five of these, and chances are you're one of us. And I sat in my dorm room, Joseph, with that brochure and had my first burning bush, holy crap, this is about me, not my friends, what the hell do I do now moment, and cried my eyes out. I mean, I think some relief in there, some absolute horror, fear, holy moly, if it's me now, what do I do? And so when I was able to compose myself, I called the same number back, and not the same guy who was a cop. I don't know whenever he ever was a cop because he was always on the phone at this club and said, I called you the other day and I don't need an Al-Anon meeting. I need my own meeting. And he said, well, it's an hour earlier and we'll see you then. So that was a Wednesday. And 2 days later on that Friday, September 25th, 85, I walked in and I've been going ever since.
Cool story. I like the part with the moment of clarity. It just seems to come out of nowhere. A lot of folks, you'll know in the meetings, will say, well, I was saved by grace. Nothing I did. I don't particularly, anytime I hear the story, I always look for the turn. There's a turn somewhere. You did a pamphlet. You took some direction, even so small. The scriptures say we turn towards God and then he turns towards us. If you look at, you know, I Googled, 1,000 years from now, the anthropologists are going to come up with the agreement that the society, if not the world, commune with an all-knowing God named Google. And according to Google, there's something like 14 million alcoholics in the world. I believe there's more than that, but they said 14 million. And according to the GSO, there's 2 million in the rooms. How about the other 12 million? They didn't get grace? What's up? They're God's stepchildren? How come they didn't do it?
Right.
They're not taking any action. You've got to take some kind of action. Some agreement has to be made. Then that moment of clarity, that's my experience, comes in. You have to do something. This is a program of action. It's easy not to take the action, just to go on. We keep lowering the bottom. That was my experience.
I absolutely agree. I mean, yeah. And I think that my mother was divinely led to, you know, she knew me very, very well. And she knew in that first Sunday morning conversation when I was all about how much my friends drank and that they were the problem, she knew that if she had come out at that moment and said, listen, sister, you got issues. You, personally, that I would have stayed a drunk. I would have done it just to defy the truth. And instead, she took that gentle, patient, maybe you go find out a little bit about why, you know, there are alcoholics in your family, the disease in your family, the issues with your friends, and then stuck that pamphlet in the mail to me. She didn't tell me that was coming. And I think all of that was kind of divinely led. It absolutely was. I call it a divine concert of grace and opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely.
There it was. And
yeah,
when it was in front of me, and really, really in front of me,
so now you're going. So now you decided you're going to go to your first meeting.
Yeah.
Right. So you walk into your first meeting. Pardon me? Oh yeah. Oh, absolutely. I actually, my story is a little different. I came into the rooms because my wife had become unmanageable, and I came in initially to stall off a divorce. Eventually, I went to therapy, and the therapist, after about a year, we made some breakthroughs too, said, how about not drinking for a year? And I said, that's crazy. I can quit anytime, just not today.
Right.
And then the wife threatened me with divorce, and I said, look, I'm telling you, I'm not an alcoholic. And she said, fine. So I went just to pacify her until the divorce came down and I was beaten into that state of reasonableness that Bill W. talks about. Now, that was my moment of clarity. I'm a tough guy. I think most drunks are. And I had to be beaten into a state of near unconscious realization.
Oh, yeah. And by the time I actually got to my first meeting, and I was, you know, I was detoxing pretty heavy off of some pretty big stuff and some pretty intense chemical combinations. I mean, I'm not saying this to be overly dramatic. I think that there would have been a case for me to be, like, medically supervised.
Yeah, I'm sure.
At that point, but it's just not how it worked out. I mean, I really shook it and cried it out in my dorm room and in meetings. Because I went to that first meeting, I found that little white house at the end of the street by the railroad track down the road from my dorm, and I walked in there with nothing but wide eyes, and I don't mean like super trusting, just holy God, where am I? How did I get here? I shook like a leaf, cried my eyes out, had these lovely people, Margaret and JB, who many years later ended up coming to my wedding, lovely couple, kind of steer me in because they could see me coming and say, here's coffee. Here's a chair. You don't have to get up for an hour. Matter of fact, you can stay there for a couple hours if you'd like. And I lived in that club, lived in it. When I wasn't in classes and I wasn't at work, I was in a meeting someplace because I didn't trust myself to be alone for an instant, for quite some time.
You're lucky in the sense that you were only 25 at the time. My experience is if you get a little older, and a lot of drunks came in older, and back when, I remember an old timer said we couldn't tell the men from the women because they were so crusty at the time. a lot of low bottom. I came up with this because people coming in now are coming in. We're not going to the hospitals and the and Skid Row like they did initially. You know, I could go to Skid Row that I already know, and like Bob and Bill, I can go to the hospital. Now I hear tell they come in under their own steam, washed but not clean, and desperate for simple instruction. The next time this golden opportunity walks through the doors, I will push and shove and help them find their seat so my own recovery becomes complete. That seems to be more of the experience now, people walking through the doors. Now, did you get a spot right away, or did you just kind of languish in the rooms and the meetings became your recovery?
Did I get a sponsor right away?
Yes.
Okay, sorry, it broke up there for a second. As I recall, I got a sponsor pretty quickly. One of the things that was true about me is that, you know, I had been training to be an entertainer, you know, a dancer, singer, actress type since I was a kid. So, you know, I was used to being on stage. And when I got cleaned up enough that my, you know, my eyes cleared up and my skin cleared up and I wasn't puking all the time and shaking all the time, I was like, plus I was like the youngest thing that group had seen in a really long time. I got sober in a group of old-timer, big book something, you know, black print, white page folks. So I got all cleaned up, and, you know, 4 or 5 months later, I was like the star attraction in my mind. I could memorize the big book. I could throw all this out at you. I could tell you how it worked until this woman got a hold of me, this woman named Virginia. I'll never forget her. She was 100 years old. She smoked like a chimney. She was the scariest thing I had ever seen or heard. She'd been sober for 1,000 years. And I was popping off in some meeting at 4 months sober about how I was going to be doing this ridiculously remarkable fourth step. And she got in front of me. She got between me and the door. This is when you could smoke in these clubs, right? She got between me and the door after this meeting was over and said, "Let me tell you something, Missy. You want to get back to a drink faster than you could to make your little head spin, and you go on talking about all the shit you think you know." Oh, excuse my language. All the stuff you think you know, all the things that you think you know about a fourth step, when the last thing you are is searching, fearless, moral, or honest, you go right ahead. Scared the living you. Well, and I
wow, that was good.
She was. And gravelly, you know, with the cigarette hanging out of her mouth, scared the living crap out of me. And I think I got a sponsor like really soon after that, where I was really curious about, okay, well, we're going to take a little bit of time with this now and work our way through it, like, for real. And, you know, I had, oh, my goodness, it was probably not until I did the steps, you know, a formal pass through the steps, the third or maybe the fourth time that I was, I believe, as thorough and honest on that fourth as I possibly could be. I mean, the first couple passes, I gave it a really honest effort, but I just didn't know how to go deep until I'd done it 3 or 4 times. But, yeah, I got a sponsor fairly soon. I didn't get really humble about the whole thing for a little while.
I understand. I have that agreement myself. It took me years. I stole off a fourth step for, I don't even want to tell you for how many years, because I was going to get this program by going to enough meetings, and I was going to get this program through the process of osmosis. You know what osmosis is?
I certainly do.
If I sit in enough meetings, the message was going to come up through the floor, up the chair, up my ass, and into my head, and I wouldn't have any work to do. I'm going to get
this thing.
I'm going to get this thing always in search of the easier, softer way, even in recovery.
Yes.
And until life on life's terms, I was beaten into a state of reasonableness again. Then I worked the steps. And that's what made all the difference for me.
Yep. Me too.
Now your sponsor, you said you went through the steps a couple times. Did you have a spiritual experience or a spiritual awakening the first time out?
You know, it was interesting about, and I don't remember where I was in the steps when I had my big spiritual experience, where the obsession was removed and has been gone since then. I was about 9 months sober. I was in North Carolina for the summer with my dad and my stepmom in a very, very small town. She was going back to college to get her master's degree, and they had come up for that, and I was staying with them while they did that, and she made sure that I made it to meetings. My dad never really understood the disease concept. He was supportive and such, but she made sure I made it to meetings, and so I met some folks, whatever. But I was walking. I can't ever say that what I was doing was hiking, because I've never been too big on hiking. But I remember walking by myself in these little mountains of North Carolina during this trip, and taking this little solitary walk, and was hit by the biggest compulsion to drink that I had had since I'd walked in. You know, I'd been performing my sobriety up to that point and trying to make it look good instead of really, I believe, internalizing it. And I think that's why there was so much room in my head and my spirit for this compulsion to come in. And it hit me literally like a ton of bricks, Joseph. It knocked me on my rear end. I sat down hard on the side of this mountain, and I cried my eyes out and prayed to whatever I had been resisting with every fiber of my being up till that very moment, and said, you have to take this. I can't do this. I will do everything else. You have to take the obsession. And it's been gone ever since. That was my absolute moment of truth. I can call on it like it was yesterday. I've used it as the thing, the experience by which I balance all other attempts at truth in my life since. And it guided the rest of it. It was the starting over place for me.
I call it the unidentifying flight. I'm sorry?
I said that's when the real work started.
And how long were you sober at the time when that happened?
9-10 months.
Okay. I call it the unidentified flying thirst. It comes out of nowhere. We don't know where it comes from, but just somehow, some way, it just sounds like a good idea. All the consequences are put aside. All of the pain of the past is gone. All that sounds good is getting the easy comfort, and it's okay.
Yep.
And some don't even think that deep. They're just going to have that drink, and all thinking goes to side. And at least I could see you had the presence of mind to be scared.
Oh, it scared the life out of me. It knocked the breath out of me. It was horrific and huge and the biggest turning over ever. Again, it's really provided me with such a balancing point since that time.
My experience is some folks get a spiritual experience. Bill W. talks about it. It's in the big book, a burning bush experience, we call it. Lightning. It was like lightning. The lights went on. One with God, feeling the spirit of the universe. Just really found something supernatural and unworldly. And one thing, even after it happened, he questioned what had happened. And, of course, Dr. Silkworth, a medical saint as he was, confirmed that Bill had a psychic experience that probably would see him through. And the last part of his statement was real interesting. I study the things like this. I'm in religion and stuff. And what happened to Bill was not that uncommon. There's other places where similar situations, almost with common threads, happen. So it really confirms
what happened to Bill is really a true spiritual touching from God, knowing that this was necessary. This is part of the problem I have with some of the other recovery programs where they, you know, it's Jesus and Heavenly Father, which I'm a Christian. I believe Jesus is the Christ, and that's fine. But my argument is that what happened to the rest of the folks? You can't give them meat. You don't give milk. Otherwise, they shall perish. So this is spiritual kindergarten to me. We have to take them, you take them where you find them, but you don't have to leave them there. And a lot of folks understand that. Dr. Bob had Jesus. He was prayed over. He was sliced and diced more than a Christmas turkey. He read the scriptures every day but couldn't stay sober. Doesn't that tell you something? Jesus has been around a long time. Jesus wouldn't have put this, the 12 steps and the big book, as inspiration to Bill if it wasn't needed.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I digress. I get excited with some of this stuff. What I find, especially with my sponsees, the folks that get passionate about recovery, they get passionate about being of service to their fellows, attain and maintain long-term sobriety.
Well, I'll tell you what. I had probably my third sponsor who really drilled it into me that she didn't bring it. I mean, she brought it up repeatedly as far as the service work was concerned, but when she knew I could really hear that service was the reason that this grace had worked in our lives like this, for us to be of service, that was another turning point for me. And that was a few years in, that was 4 or 5 years in, that I started to realize that, wow, this really is about, you know, on a go-forth basis, because the first several years of my sobriety were about what I was getting away from. Get away from the pain, get away from the shame, get away from the humiliation. You know, then you get to a point where you can learn from it and it can become some useful information so that it should be part of your go toward. What am I going toward? What did I learn from this that will help me go forward and be of use, be a useful member, contributing member of society? And since that time, probably 5 or 6 years in, that really has been